Hey everyone, and welcome back to No Earthly Explanation. This is the podcast where we dive in and investigate the things that are just unexplainable. For those of you that are new to listening to this, I am your scientific host, Ellie Ringo of Ellie Knows Rocks. And with me is our investigative host, Dawn Schmidt. How are you doing this evening, Dawn? I'm trying to choke on my own spit here.
It left you speechless.
It totally did.
Mitch, am I being here? Wow. I'm so flattered. Oh, great to always be with you, Ellie. So how have you been?
Oh, I've been doing really well. I've actually been selling a ton of my mineral kits, which is awesome. It's hard for me to keep up making them. So I've spent all of this week getting all of my new supplies. So it's just been like one trip to the post office after the next, which has been great.
I sing in a choral group, so we've just completed two concerts, and then we have another one at the theater this coming Saturday. So between that and a lot of dress rehearsals, and then separate rehearsals with the musicians, and so it's that time of year.
That's awesome. So I mean,
keeps me grounded. I love it.
For our listeners, we are filming this really close to the holidays. So, I mean, I didn't know, Dawn, that you still did like a chorale. Do you guys like do the door to door like Christmas carols or that kind of thing?
No. We have our own theater, and then we perform also at Basilica, and a couple we performed at the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. We've sang with everyone from the Florentine Opera to people that sing professionally even throughout the country. And whenever we have visiting college groups that we're always invited to sing as far as participate as far as in their performances. And so I love it. It's a love that goes all the way back to my childhood, but starting a church choir, but now able to sing professionally with just some of the best singers around. As I said, it keeps me very well grounded. It keeps my head focused as to priorities.
I mean, that is absolutely phenomenal to hear, Dawn. Well, let's jump into our episode. Today's episode is kind of a different one. We're actually going to get a bunch of questions, read to us, I'm assuming, by our listeners. And with us today is our producer, Todd Fisher, and he will be on the show letting us know what you guys think of us and the questions that you would like answered. So how are you doing today, Todd?
Hi, guys. Good to be back. Hi, Dawn.
Todd, I haven't seen you in years. So how have you been?
It's weird to come back and just be able to do the listener questions since in season two, I was co-hosting quite a bit because we had a former co-host who played hooky a lot, I think. So I was filling in a lot more last season. But we have Ellie now to do this, so I don't have to show up as often, folks. So you'll only be hopefully hearing from me once a season.
Oh, well, we love you, Todd. We're glad you're here.
Yeah, so this is listener questions. But before we get into that, yes, Let's talk about something else cool that's going on, because this is a good opportunity to dig into it. No pun intended.
Oh my gosh.
You guys are doing this Crown International experience,
yes,
that is going to allow 10 people to go to the actual debris field and be in an archaeological dig of the site. That's like a great experience. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that's going to be like?
Well, this is the actual Roswell debris field from 1947. This is where the ranch foreman, W.W. Brazel, discovered this huge debris field of all this strange material that covered an area of almost a mile long. And then the military would spend three full days, 50 to 60 troops, clearing up every last shard, every last piece of wreckage. As they were told, if it doesn't move, bag it. And trucks driving back and forth, transporting the wreckage back to the Roswell Army Airfield in Roswell at that time. But needless to say, they didn't get every piece, because we've had witnesses approach us through the years, and we would hear story after story of how 10, 15, 20, even 30, 40 years after the incident, heavy rain, wind erosion would wash a piece or two up to the surface. And just like that, they'd get a knock on their door. Good old Uncle Sam was there once again to retrieve it, recover it, claiming that it was national security. Well, good enough for us, because we know, and Ellie would agree, that there's no such thing as completely and scouring a crash site and removing every last remnant of the wreckage.
Yep.
And so we mapped out a systematic grid. We mapped areas of potential entrapment. We used the theodolite, and we surveyed the entire site after we had multiple firsthand witnesses take us independently to the very same location. No doubt we're at the ground zero of Roswell in 1947. And so in September of 89, we did all that. And then we had a major archaeological dig in 2002, sponsored by the Sci-Fi Channel. Then another one with Sci-Fi and Peacock, which is NBC, in 2006. And then we had another one in 2013. And then we did an area that was a depository site about a mile down from the area where all the sediment, all the runoff from the location would accumulate. And it's time for us to go back. And there's still a good part of the area that we have not searched, that we need to go in with metal detectors, with shaker boxes. We need people to actually assist and be part of what we always have considered something very historic, and accepting that what happened there, that in itself puts it in the same league as being at a famous battlefield. Imagine, our listeners, if you could do something like this, like at the Alamo or Little Bighorn or Gettysburg. And this just happens to be the most famous of all UFO incidents, the Roswell crash site.
And 10 people can go to this on April 20th and 21st of next year. And all of those details are on the website crowninternational.us. So just look for the experiences section of that website and look at how you can participate in this historic archaeological dig. And just one thing to add to what you just said, Don, back when Sci-Fi Channel sponsored the dig, you and I were part of that. And I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that was that the first time that maybe scientifically we did prove that that was the debris field, because the University of New Mexico's contract archaeology department was there. And to my recollection, their findings were so conclusive that, the book came out, the Roswell Dig Diaries, and half of that book is actually the scientific study, and the other half are the diaries, the journal entries of the dig team members.
Well, in 89, we did have archaeologists from Argonne Laboratories. We had our scientific director from the Center for UFO Studies, Dr. Mark Rodiger. There were scientists who were part of that entire project. But again, it was mapping it out. It was preparing. Mm-hmm. It was getting ready for the 2002. And it's just that it took that many years, not only put together the funding, but then put together all the personnel involved. And that's why it's going to be so wonderful that scientifically that Ellie will be leading this project along with a number of in her capacity as a geologist, and we'll have a number of archaeologists also on board and potentially another geologist, but that we're going to try to really move the needle, so to speak, mm-hmm. and cover more ground, mm-hmm. and especially areas of more likelihood of finding something. And that's something else that the listeners also have to consider. Just imagine for any one of you to be there, should we actually find something that would once and for all prove that this indeed, was something of no earthly origin, no earthly, manufacture.
Sure.
And talk about, being part of history.
I believe one of the things that I thought was really fascinating with the 2002 dig was I remember them proving the existence of the furrow, that the furrow was the gouge, not right. Yeah, the gouge was not a natural occurrence.
No. And the fact that we had, again, multiple independent witnesses who told us exactly where that gouge was, that back at the time, after the military had completed the cleanup, that people still ventured out there. You know, they still were looking around, hoping that something remained. And there was that telltale, you know, fingerprint of the crash, of the midair explosion that rained all that debris to that, you know, site. And always described about 10 foot in width, a few inches deep, hundreds of feet long. And we flagged that, as you remember, Todd. We marked it as far as in 20-foot intervals. And then when we had Alicat, the archaeologist who operated the tractor backhoe, and we had him dig perpendicular to the marked area for the furrow, and the way his ground engineer, watched as the shovel would jump, that it was hitting that pocket of loose sediment, and pulling it away, there it was, that symmetrical V right below the surface. I mean, and I'll never forget the archaeologist, Dr. Bill Dolman from the university calling up, and he was elated. He was practically jumping up and down. Don, it's exactly where you said it was. No, it's exactly where the eyewitnesses said it was. And so you're absolutely right, correct, Todd, that we confirmed an impact. We confirmed that something did actually strike the ground.
Yep.
And created that gouge back in 1947. And the other thing is, there were aerial photographs taken of the area by the Bureau of Land Management just the year before. There's no such furrow. It's not there. It's just happened at the exact same time that damn weather balloon came down. And as anyone who knows anything about weather balloons, they don't make gouges.
They're light. Any impact. They're lightweight.
I know.
All right, you guys, let's get on these listener questions, because they're, who knows? But everybody, go take a look at crowninternational.us and look and see how you can participate in this historic dig. And let's go ahead and dive into some of these. So these are actual listener questions. We do this every season, at least once a season. And they're always fun. So there's a lot of great ones on here for you, Ellie. I think people really want to get to know you.
Uh-oh.
So I'm going to start with you, because Don just did all the talking for 10 minutes. So I'm going to move it over to Ellie.
Don has a lot of good points to make.
So the first question is to Ellie. What's the weirdest thing you've ever found while rock collecting?
Oh, man. A lot. But the... Cute. The listeners that are listening to this, we see each other on video, so I can see everybody's reaction faces. So if I laugh and not say anything, that was why. Anyways, so there are a lot of different like geologic anomalies that happen just when you're walking around and you find things that shouldn't be there or shouldn't happen. And so one of them for me is actually a complete replica of a prickly pear cactus that was replaced with gypsum and selenite. And for those of you that know what gypsum is, it's an evaporite mineral. It happens in lacustrian areas after a flood has come in, certain amount of salts and minerals that make up gypsum and or elements that make up gypsum and selenite will evaporate out, and sometimes they'll pseudomorph and they'll form around something else. And so I just thought it was cool. It was like lumpy and had a bunch of dirt on it. And I was like, oh, I don't know what this is, but I wanted to put it in my backpack anyways. Well, it was stabbing me. And I was like, this is not cool. I had a real thin backpack on at the time. So I took it out and I was like figuring out what was in there. And I got it in the sunlight just right. And you could actually see the shriveled up cactus inside of this pseudomorphed outside. And I was looking at it, I was like, oh my gosh, it's actually a cactus. I was blown away that could happen. And I've never seen one before. People have talked about that they've seen some skeletal remains of cactus be covered with minerals and pseudomorphed to more of a petrification. but nothing with like a soft form mineral. So it was really neat that it pseudomorphed around a freaking prickly pear cactus out here in Arizona.
That's very cool. Don, the next question's to you. I do have several. Obviously, there are several here that are Roswell related. So we're going to go ahead and start off with one of those. This listener wants to know, were there witnesses that saw the UFO in the air before it crashed, or was it first discovered by its debris?
There indeed were numerous witnesses who saw it airborne, or then would then assume that it was the same craft, as they would hear the rumors of the crash, specifically northwest of Roswell. And there was a family, a husband and wife, Mr. and Mrs. Daniel Wilmont, to begin with, who lived in the western portion of Roswell. And it was late that afternoon, they saw a dome disc that moved from the south and then moved directly west of town and up towards that very area. So what was interesting is that they reported it to the sheriff's department, and it would make the newspaper, the Roswell Daily Record, the very next day. And little did anyone realize that within the next few days, there would be the reports of this crashed, you know, flying saucer northwest of town. And then through the years of our investigation, we would learn, for example, that there were sisters at St. Mary's Hospital who had logged in the very evening in question, seeing what looked like a shooting star, but that it was bright red, and it arced downward, and it went across the sky, and again, it came down northwest of Roswell, or at least it appeared to them to have that trajectory. And then there was a military police officer who was on the south end of the tarmac at the Roswell Army Airfield, and he described a similar thing, that he saw something that flashed across the sky and that it was moving in that direction. And so, again, we don't have anyone that actually saw it crash. We don't have anyone who saw it explode, but there were enough sightings in the area and at the time in question that have never been explained to suggest that one of them may have indeed witnessed the very object before it exploded.
Did the newspaper, how did they describe it? Did they describe it as lights or as a saucer?
The Wilmot case, they described as a dome disc because it was broad daylight.
Interesting.
It was a late afternoon. And in their case, dome disc. Yes.
Right.
And they used the very term flying saucer.
Fascinating. Wow. Is that, and just, I guess I have a, is that the first time flying saucer was used?
No. It would have happened just a week before the famous Kenneth Arnold sighting. He was a search rescue pilot, and he was flying over Yakima, Washington, and he had that sighting of those nine crescent-shaped objects, and he described them to the newspapers that they maneuvered like saucers skipping across the water. And it was a reporter by the name of Bill Bichette at the Oregonian newspaper who then coined that very phrase, flying saucer.
Wow.
And a term that would last forever. Yeah. Ellie, next one here is for you. When did you become interested in geology? And what do you think of the Girl Scouts? Would you come to my troop meeting?
I can see Boy Scouts, but the Girl Scouts, come on.
So I first got interested in I was collecting rocks since I was a kid, and I didn't know what geology was when I was 8 years old collecting agates on the beach with my dad. I just thought it was amazing and fun, and they were pretty, and I still actually have the agate collection that I collected with my dad today, and I have it color categorized in jars and stuff. But I didn't know what it was until I was much older, and I decided to go to the Virgin Valley, Nevada, to the Royal Opal Peacock Mine to look for precious fire opal in Nevada. And I thought, oh, this will be fun. You know, I can just go like dig around, because I was always really fascinated with road cuts and things and just rocks in general. So I went up there and I dug around, and it was pouring down rain and I was covered with mud and clay, but I stayed out there like all day. And I found a, I don't know, like a $400 piece of opal. I was super excited. And I went home and I literally Googled how to look for rocks for a living. And it came up with geology, because I did literally, I didn't know what it was. I worked at a bank at the time. It was a horrible job and I wanted out of it. So right then and there, I decided I would go to college and I was going to quit my job and I was going to be a geologist come hell or high water. And so it's exactly what I did. I dove in head first into college. I had a high school diploma. That was it. And I started out my first college semester, 21 credits and a buttload of not knowing what I was doing and, you know, graduated in geology, but that's a short version.
Wow. And what do you think of the Girl Scouts?
I was never a Girl Scout. I was never a Brownie. I would go teach them all kinds of stuff about geology if they wanted me to. Everybody loves to learn new things and find things fun to, you know, look at. So I love teaching, especially little girls, that as you get older, you can be your own boss. You can dominate. You can do all kinds of things. Don't let anybody ever put you down. And so if I can teach that to other little girls, that's amazing. I have a lot of younger kids that follow me that are enamored with what I do, because I don't hold things back and I don't put like a limit on it. And you know, if I want to look all dressed up and pretty and go out and look for rocks, I'm going to do it. If I want to get out there in my sweatpants and a funky t-shirt, I'm going to do that too. And I don't care if people judge me. And I think that other little girls need to know that as well.
So if there's any Girl Scout troops out there that want Ellie to show up, you can either find her at Ellie Knows Rocks out there on social media, or you can go to Crown International Management Group and you can book her through that. So
that's right.
Certainly.
Well, I would imagine there would be merit badges for rock hunting and rock collecting and that type of thing. So,
heck yeah.
I'm sure it'd be something that would be. Yeah.
Oh, maybe they can make a badge after my little crystal logo with multicolors. That would be so cool.
You think there's,
it out there to the Girl Scouts.
Do you think there's a badge for UFO hunting?
That's going to be a stretch.
Don, these are two different questions, but I'm going to kind of put them together as a two-parter here because they're kind of related. So the next question is, do you believe the UFO that crashed in Roswell was a traditional saucer shape or some other design?
Ooh.
Well, because it had essentially exploded, as even the first people who arrived on the scene, based on the pattern in which the debris was scattered, they immediately concluded that it was a mere explosion from a considerable height. And as a result, even their efforts in trying to piece together some of the wreckage, and because so much of it was just no bigger than your fingertip, your nail pinky, that type of thing, where would you even begin? The largest piece we ever had described is about 4 foot in diameter. And as a result, I don't think it would have even been practical to put together that puzzle. But then we have the pod. We have the site that we worked just this last April, 35 miles north of Roswell. And this is the site that the remains of the craft, the egg-shaped pod, the capsule, whether it was an escape capsule, we can only imagine. Just that two of the bodies and the survivor were recovered there. There were no bodies described at the debris field, which we're going to next year. But that indeed may have been the dome portion of a flying saucer. The idea that the dome would actually be the cockpit, the capsule as described, egg-shaped, and that you had a circular saucer that then enveloped, that surrounded it. And so, again, it would be just rank speculation on my part. The only thing being that there was a series of photographs taken over Phoenix by William Rhodes on July 7th. So at the very same time, and it was a domed but heel-shaped craft. So almost crescent, like I had mentioned before with the Kenneth Arnold sightings, that it was round in the front and it was curved in the back and then with a center dome. Was it that very craft? We don't know.
I've often wondered, you know, when the stealth bomber came out, you couldn't mm-hmm. photograph the stealth fighters and the stealth bombers from certain angles in Correct. The beginning. But what was Correct. Fascinating about the design of that craft was from the front, it looks like a saucer shape. From when you see it from the top, it's actually more like an arrowhead design. And I've often mm-hmm. heard people mm-hmm. talk about if, in fact, the UFO was reverse engineered, that maybe that was the shape that they came up with. Do you think there's any weight to that?
Well, that bat wing, that wing-shaped craft would go all the way back not only to the Horton brothers of World War II, the Nazis, the Germans, they were experimenting already with wing-shaped aircraft. And then you have the Northrop Flying Wing, which became one of our earlier bombers. In 1947, it was headquartered at what would become Edwards Air Force Base in California. And at the time, what's interesting that you mentioned that, Todd, there were inquiries from the Pentagon to, at the time, it was Muroc Army Airfield. That's what became Edwards that next January. But the Pentagon inquired as to the whereabouts, if Muroc could account for all of their flying wings at the time of Roswell. And the explanation that came back, that all had been grounded, they were being converted to jet propulsion. But nonetheless, we have every one of them right here. But interesting that the Pentagon would make, you know, would make, pose that question at the very time of Roswell. The other thing is the Air Intelligence Research Department also made inquiries as a result of Roswell as to the location of the Horton brothers. They wanted to account for all of the German flying wings also at that time. So is that to suggest that what had crashed outside of Roswell was wing-shaped? That indeed that they had made some determination that it wasn't totally circular, that it was more of a wing.
Let me ask you this, and then I'll give you the second part of this listener's question. If the craft did in fact have an explosion in the air, does that maybe say that it was something combustible on the craft, or maybe the craft just maybe imploded on itself or depressurized or something? What's your opinion on that? Because wouldn't you know there was something that had burned on the debris field?
And there were indications of charred and scorched areas. In fact, even at the impact site, even the deputy sheriffs that were sent out from Roswell talked about the whole side of a Arroyo that had been scorched. Okay. Now, we have confirmed it was a severe lightning storm at the time in question. The Stallion Network, the records determined that there was a bad storm that came off the southern Capitan Mountains at that very time, that very evening. And so it would cause us to question, was it possibly struck by lightning? Well, one of the things that we're looking into presently, and I had a former radar operator with the CIA actually make this suggestion, because radar was in its infancy at that time in 1947. And there were no regulations as to the frequencies that were being used. White Sands Proving Ground had the most sophisticated radar in the world at that time. They tracked both incoming and outgoing. Everyone else only tracked incoming. But there were radar systems at White Sands, at Roswell, at Cannon Air Force, in Clovis, New Mexico, to the northeast. In Albuquerque, there was Kirtland, and then there were substations in Vaughan and also west of Socorro. Where did all of these radar lobes bisect? Where did they all intersect? Where the crash took place, Lincoln County.
Wow.
And so what this engineer with the CIA was suggesting, that because of the different frequencies and that none of them meshed, that it would have caused so much interference that if you get caught up in that type of, it would jam your system, and it potentially could cause you literally to explode. So that's something we're going to be looking into. Yes, yes.
Well, that, I had heard, and maybe this is just, you know, folklore, but I had always heard that early radar was so powerful that, you know, birds would fall out of the sky when they would fly through it.
That is true. Yes, because, again, there were no regulations on the frequency. They just cranked it up, and they were so excited in experimenting as far as with this new technology that they literally were scorching the air around them. And so, and I've talked to pilots who, from that era, who talked about, you always knew that when your instruments went haywire, you were flying through as far as radar.
The next question I have for you, Don, is where do you think the bodies from the Roswell crash ended up?
Well, we know they immediately went to Wright Field, Wright-Patterson in Dayton, Ohio. We know a number of the bodies transited through Fort Worth, which was going up the chain of command, Carswell Army Airfield. The head of the 8th Air Force there, General Roger Ramey, he was the commanding officer over the commander at Roswell, who was Colonel William Blanchard. And from there, we have heard a number of the bodies went to Bethesda, the Naval Hospital in Washington. And presently, we're convinced that there are at least 5 bodies at Dugway in Utah. And Dugway is often called the second Area 51. And Dugway also is unique in that it has the Biological Medical Research Facility. So it would be the perfect place to cryogenically preserve unique specimens, which these bodies would be. I don't believe there are any remains still at Wright-Patt in Dayton. I think they have all been permanently, you know, preserved at one facility, and probably, you know, hundreds of feet down below the surface of the ground.
Interesting. Ellie, back to you. This one, I'm very interested about this one.
Uh-oh.
Can you tell me a behind-the-scenes story from Frozen Gold that never aired on TV?
Yeah.
Tell everyone a little, for those that don't know, tell them about Frozen Gold first and just set up what that was about.
This Frozen Gold is a TV series that aired on the Weather Channel between November 8th of 2022 until March, or no, 2022 until March of 2023. Is that right?
It sounds right.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry. Difficult sometimes to remember. Anyways, but they are still doing reruns of the whole thing, and I get messages from people all the time. Hey, I just saw you on TV.
It's a reality show, right?
It's a reality TV show about 6 Americans that went to Greenland to look for gold. And we actually started one of the first placer mining operations to look for gold in the the glacial till and glacial moraines in Greenland. And so it was awesome from a geology prospect. It was amazing. I got to find things and do some research that I never thought I would be able to do. I made some great friends there in Greenland. The people there are phenomenal. Like, the people in Greenland are amazing. And so I'm so grateful. The Americans I went with, however, not so amazing. Ray is the exception. He's a cool old dude from Alaska. He's pretty awesome. Christian's okay. The rest of them are psycho. And so a fun story that never aired, this is one of my favorites. Actually, there was a bunch that didn't. And so, but this one actually scared me to death. I am sitting there with my producer and my storyteller and the director and our safety pro, and we're all in this huge tent with these heaters and stuff because it's cold. It's Greenland, people. It's in the summertime, but it's like 40 degrees outside. I'm from Arizona. When it's 70 degrees, you get your jacket and you're freezing, you know? So 40 degrees was like awfully freezing. But every time our director and our producer would come over, they would bring bottles of booze. And then, you know, we'd pass them around. We'd all just chit chat about the day. So there's a fair few of us in there. I'm talking to one of the DPs. I'm so excited about my drink because it had a piece of an iceberg that we chipped off from the shoreline. And so I am cooling my booze with a piece of iceberg. Who gets to do that, right?
That's great.
So I was just like, oh, this is so cool. And they were asking me about my history and how I grew up in a zoo and all of these things. And all of a sudden, the door comes slamming open. One of the twins rushes in and says, "She's a liar. She's a cheat. She's going to get us all arrested." And everybody looks at the door and went, "What? What's going on?" And I sat there and she's like, "She's a horrible person." She's like pointing at me. And I'm like, "What are you guys talking about?" She's all, "She said to everybody, she's told the world that everybody's doing drugs." And I went, "Excuse me?" And I'm sitting there, I'm holding my drink and I'm looking over at the producer and the safety guy going, "These people are nuts. I told you they were crazy. This is insane." So all of a sudden, her sister runs in behind her and leaps across the table at me. I jump up out of my chair and I run around to my producer and the director going, "I don't know what they're on or what's going on, but please like protect me. I don't want to get beat up." And they just went apeshit crazy. Oh, sorry. I probably can't say that on here. I apologize. Okay. They just went nuts. Okay. And like for no reason, I still don't know, but apparently somebody had told them that I started a rumor that everybody on site was doing drugs and that we were all going to get arrested at the airport. I literally have no idea what they were talking about, but boy, it made for an interesting, really exciting evening. And I got to watch a larger middle-aged woman roll off a table and fall onto the floor, which was really entertaining.
This is what happens when you put a bunch of crazy people in an isolated Arctic area. Didn't you see the movie The Thing?
That's right.
So, I mean, it was a blast.
Cabin fever.
Yeah, cabin fever, yeah.
I mean, that's so great. Needless to say, I slept with a knife under my pillow. Nothing towards, you know, anybody that was there. The crew was awesome. I can't say enough about them. The people were cool. It was the Americans they hired. They really needed to vet these people a little bit better.
Wow. That's incredible. Don, back to you. This is interesting. When someone comes forward claiming to have information on Roswell, how do you investigate their claims? Ooh. Is there a vetting process that you do as an investigator? How does that work?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, one of the wonderful tools that we had from the very beginning is there were only 2 years that the Roswell Army Airfield actually had an annual yearbook. And 1947 happened to be one of them. And a good half of the personnel on the base at that time are in the book. We had all of these names to start with. And it was just a matter of back at the time when you didn't have like a CD-ROM that you could pop in and you could, you know, track down the whereabouts or go online and enter a name and, you know, come up with their phone number and their address. We had to actually track these people down. We had nothing but names, but nonetheless, we had starting points. And the other thing is that we had city directories from Roswell. Oh, so you claim you worked at, you know, at the lumber yard in Roswell back at that time, and you better be in that city directory. And then we also had phone books from Roswell in 1947. So first thing is you establish their being at the scene of the crime, so to speak, that they're there. And if not, well, you better have good documentation demonstrating how you happened to be there at the time. Now, one of them, for example, he was a crash investigator for Boeing Airlines at that time. And he just happened to have two homes, One was in Western Texas and one was in Hobbs, New Mexico, east of Roswell, about an hour east of Roswell. Well, he had just finished work at the White Sands Proving Ground on a crash investigation, and he passed through Roswell. And wouldn't you know it, he was at the base and they said, "We have something we'd like you to look at." So they drove him out to the crash site and they asked him, you know, "What do you make of this?" I mean, he was a, you know, a crash investigator at that time working for Boeing. And it was something that he would confess to his son and daughter before he died. And, you know, he swore to God that it did happen. And his bona fides checked out. He was who he claimed he was. So, yes, we absolutely vet all of our witnesses. But the one thing I need to emphasize to both of you is that anytime a witness would ever come forward to us, our shields would go up. Mm-hmm. Because the vast majority of the Roswell witnesses are very reluctant because of all the intimidation, of all the threats, winding up in Leavenworth Prison, being physically, you know, harmed, civilians having their children killed if they ever spoke out of turn, that type of thing. And so, well, if you were, you know, legitimately, you know, threatened over this situation, why are you now volunteering the story? Why are you talking? Most of the time, it required us to build up their confidence in us before they finally, little by little, would talk. And in some cases, it took years to finally break a witness into telling us what they had witnessed, what they experienced. So it goes both ways. So, but I think it's a good rule of thumb. Anytime someone waves their hand and say, "Wait, you forgot about me," turn and walk the other way. Chances are they're not legit.
Right. We're getting down to the last few questions here. Ellie, what's your favorite kind of rock or crystal?
Oh, man, I hate this question. Absolutely hate this question because it changes daily, and that's not my fault. It changes daily.
Do you have a top three?
I have a top some. So rocks and minerals are two very different things. Just to preface this, a mineral is made up of one or more elements, and a rock is made up of one or two or more minerals. So very different. But if I have a favorite rock, it is definitely a gneissic banded metamorphic rock. And you all can look this up. They're very beautiful. I absolutely love them. The best ones that I've ever seen or stood next to were in Greenland. They're beautiful, nice there. And I would say that in my top three favorite minerals, corundum's at the top. I absolutely love corundum. It makes both sapphires and rubies, for those of you wondering. I really love turquoise because it's just stunning. I love aragonite. I like most beryl just because it looks pretty cool. And topaz is kind of up there as well. So I don't have like a specific. And I mean, if I'm in a mood where I'm opening geodes all day, that's my new favorite. Oh my gosh, I have to figure that out. It's an all-encompassing love for a lot of minerals, as long as they're pretty and well-structured. I mean, if you pick up a yard rock and show it to me, I'm going to throw it right back in the yard. So,
aw, those yard rocks need love too. Come on.
Oh, they do. They get.
You probably don't pick out the ugly puppy either, huh?
Oh, I'm not a puppy person, no. But I'll pick out the ugly cat.
Don, what's your favorite rock? Do you have a favorite rock?
Kryptonite.
Kryptonite. Okay. So gosh, didn't know we could put, you know, fictitious rocks in this question.
Yeah, neither
but I guess,
did I.
I guess okay. We could.
Because unobtainium is not real, but they made a whole movie about it.
They did. That's very important. Very important.
In fact, my first engagement, she didn't want to have a diamond. So we shopped and we went rock hunting all over, and she was finding like white pearl opals. And then she was doing something because she was casting her own jewelry. And so she was even doing things with turquoise. So I have a lot of experience. In fact, I have a clock that has turquoise as far as all the numbers that was given to me by a judge in New Mexico. And so it's something that hangs in my studio.
Very cool.
I think for me, you know, I'm a fan of dark tourism and dark collecting and things like this. And I think I would want to possess a piece of highly radioactive trinitite from the Trinity explosion and have that on display in my house. That would be nice. Okay.
I just bought some the other day.
Did you?
Yeah. So someone was selling it on Facebook yard sales. And I was like, wait, what? And I went, checked it out. It was really small, but it was legit because my stepson absolutely loves anything to do with wartime history. And so I was like, I'm going to buy this for him. And then I told him, I said, I'm going to go to that site someday and I'm going to do collecting of my own. You just watch. So he was thought it was cool, but I'm like, yes, I need a bigger piece.
Ellie, interesting. You do mention that because Trinity site is only open to the public.
Twice a year.
And one is in April and October. So maybe we could tie it in.
I don't think they let you collect anything there, though.
No, they don't. They don't.
They're really specific. But most of that trinitite was chipped out and used at local banks. And they turned it into keychains, which were incredibly radioactive keychains. There's actually a depository for trinitite at the, at least at the old Los Alamos Museum up there. I think they moved locations. I'm not sure if it's still there. But do you remember the depository for trinitite that was there, Don?
Yes, I do.
They would ask you. They talked about how many of these keychains were given out by the banks for people opening new accounts.
I know. Well, the craziest thing that we hear from people living in Roswell is that the very next morning, the morning after the actual detonation in July 45, and then all these people went out and to see this gray ash, and they're just casually just brushing it off with their bare hands and blowing it off their windshields, and they had no idea what it was.
Wow, they really should have let that be announced a little bit better than, hey, something's going to happen. We're not going to tell you what it is.
It wasn't until 1988 that the federal government finally acknowledged that the people through New Mexico were most likely exposed to a high level of very dirty radioactive material. So it took them 45 years. 43.
This last question I have, I wasn't sure if I was going to include, but the more I thought about it, I really wanted to kind of hear your responses. I'm going to start with the Don. Don, do you think we need to go to Mars?
I've always been very curious about Mars in the sense that I think it has enough scientific geology and enough scientific speculation to suggest that there may have been life on the planet at one time. And I'm not so sure that they have not discovered at least microscopic life on Mars, and would they even tell us? And so I was a big fan of the Apollo program. As you know, Todd, Dr. Edgar Mitchell wrote the foreword to one of my books. Neil Armstrong worked with Dr. Jalen Hynek, my scientific director. I've watched all the space launches. I mean, I was like so many people captivated by the landing on the moon. And so, no, I feel it's one of the things that we've lost in this country. We've lost that pioneer spirit, that looking beyond the next hill.
Right.
You know, traveling out, and the fact that we haven't been to the moon in 50 years. Just imagine that. Just imagine if the space program would have continued unabated through all these last five decades, where we might be right now.
Right.
Most likely would have colonized Mars by now. So no. I'm not one of those. The money is much better spent right here. Well, the money is wasted like never before. And this would be something that could be very productive and unite us again, especially that sense of accomplishment.
Ellie, same question to you, but with a little addition. I think, first of all, you know, do you think we should go to Mars? And two, from a geologist's perspective, what would you be looking for if you were there? And how different is that planet going to be from ours?
Well, from the geologic evidence that, I mean, that has been, I guess, brought back and been attained, there's not a lot of differentiation. Yeah, they've said that there was at one point water, that there was probably at one point waterfalls or maybe lakes or stuff like that. But the temperature variance on Mars is huge. I don't know if it's their north or south pole of Mars or something, but there's something like it gets down to -110 or 100 some odd degrees. It's like, that's not sustainable for life, for starters. And so essentially you're talking about like freeze drying the planet because it would get so cold. And so as far as geologic evidence for things to grow, yeah, the soil, because of the amounts of water that used to be there, degradation of things that could have been there, although I doubt there was a lot just from what they brought back. There's not a lot of carbon evidence that there was, like, you know, trees or life or forests or things that it would produce, like if you were talking about like a swamp or a regular lake, that there's not like a lot of geologic evidence in order for us to go there and like produce life. I mean, just honestly, from the temperature variance alone, people can live, sure, in 120 degrees. I know, I'm proof, but you stay indoors. But as far as it getting like down to like the negatives, you know, yeah, they've gone to Antarctica and they've experienced what -120 degrees inside of a bubble for a very, very limited amount of time. You can't expect people to go there and then endure that sort of a thing for long term. And then producing life outside of that, as far as organic matter, you're not going to get things to grow in extreme cold or extreme heat. I know I lost half my plants this year in 120 degree weather. So like I think that we need to outstretch. I think that we need to be looking for life in different places. Are we to that point? I don't think so at all. I think that outside of our galaxy, or maybe a couple galaxies away from us, sure, if we had the technology to go and probe into that, like an interstellar sort of a situation, it might be great. But it's not something that we're even remotely close to. And if we are, I don't know about it. And I love that kind of a thing. And so I try to kind of be involved. I mean, talking about like mining in space, there are more minerals like gold, platinum, and silver on giant asteroids out in space than there is on Earth. And we're depleting ours quicker than we can even produce it. So like that sort of a situation, we're closer to mining asteroids than we are like trying to get life on another planet. But I think that they need to keep developing scientific methods and theories in order for us to be able to go into space and find new things. Because with the way that our planet is, we're on the way to the dumpster, and everybody's guilty of it, and we all know it. But there's too many people here to keep sustaining life if we're growing as exponentially as we are.
Let me ask you this, Ellie. Do you think that it's possible that Mars would have the possibility to have things like, you know, precious gems? Would diamonds be there? Or is there enough evidence to support that we might have, there might be things like that on that planet?
To be honest, I don't know if there's evidence to support if there's diamonds.
How would you know from the surface? Because all the work that they do there is surface work, right? Like you really wouldn't be able to get access that deep. But is there a way with the satellites they put around that? Would you be able to know?
To be mapping anywhere where there is volcanic activity, or mm-hmm. or past volcanic activity, because diamonds are produced under pressure. Kimberlite tubes are our biggest source of diamonds across the world, and those can be buried even. And it just means a tremendous amount of pressure, a tremendous amount of heat. And if there's that sort of an evidence, then yeah, there could be. But I mean, like in the geologic stance, diamonds are pretty much worthless. They're a propaganda been made huge and hype by media. Things that are more useful are things that are used, I would say, in sandpaper, things like corundum and garnet and, you know, silica carbide and things like that. Those would be something that would be much more useful. And the only way to really determine if you have those, and again, based on that high, huge temperature difference, freezing temperatures and extreme heat deteriorate minerals quicker than water does. And so you would need to drill into the ground in order to see. I mean, minerals and rocks can withstand water on them as long as they don't have abrasion of other rocks around them for a really long time. But man, you put a rock in a freezer, depending on what type it is, for extreme freezing, it's going to crack and turn to dust. You put it out in the heat, the same exact thing is going to happen. Plus, you're going to change its chemical composition based on the radiation that that rock can absorb. So there's so many variables that you have to think about. It would have to be drilling through whatever their, you know, estimated crust would be to get minerals that were untouched by both the heat and the cold. And there is a certain like thermal cline within our crust where those minerals stay preserved because it's always going to remain the same temperature, no matter what it is, freezing or warm outside.
Well, listeners, you heard it here first. Ellie has said that diamonds are a propaganda tool perpetuated by the media. Yes. So effectively, she's lost all her endorsements with jewelry companies at this point. So
I like other stones. Diamonds just suck, man.
Let me ask you this. Is a diamond brought back from Mars going to be worth more than a diamond mined in Earth? Is it just going to be a Mars gemstone? It's going to be like, oh, I've got a Mars gemstone for my fiance. The propaganda spin is going to be Mars jewelry is going to be worth more than Martian jewelry will be worth more than our Earthling jewelry.
Okay. So the rarest diamond, which is also would be the rarest stone in the world, is a red diamond. How many of you have seen those? There are very, very few in existence, but they do exist, but they're in somebody's vault because no one's willing to give them up. If you had red diamonds coming from Mars, I mean, then it would deplete how much they would be worth here, yada, yada. But no, if you had a gemstone that came from Mars, yes, no, it'd be priceless. Because think about what happened to get it here and to go find it. That's a completely different story. But no, diamonds here on Earth.
I've got a piece of asphalt from Route 66. I'm going to put it on eBay after the show.
Hey, there you go. I want to see how much that goes for.
Well, anyways, you guys, I don't have any more questions. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, awesome. Then that is it for our episode, everybody. I hope that you appreciated this. I guess it would be a special episode for our viewer listener questions with Todd. And if you guys could please like rate, review this episode, it really helps us out because it helps other people that are like-minded find us. And if you want to know what we're up to in the future or what we're going to have on future episodes, you can check us out on Facebook and Instagram at No Earthly Explanation. And if you'd like to find me, you can find me at Ellie Knows Rocks or at Ellie Ringo. And if you would like to find Don, he's on Facebook and you can find him at Donald Raymond Schmidt. And if you would like to send us any kind of comments or more viewer questions or even, you know, suggestions for other episodes that you would like us to dive into, you can email us at noearthlyexplanation@gmail.com. But that's all I have for you guys. And we so, so appreciate you guys tuning in and listening to our episodes. So thank you.
Ellie, always great to be with you. We had fun tonight, and I'm sure we're going to have a lot more fun as the programs progress and as we gear up to the next archaeological project down in New Mexico next year. So, yes.
Yes. I hope it's just as fun as the one that we had this year. I had a blast. And so people are going to have
fun. I'll guarantee it.
Don, it was awesome talking with you. I love hearing your stories. Every time I talk to you, I hear something new, which is fabulous.
Well, a lot more from where they came from. So,
well, I'll see you later, Don. And thank you, everybody.
Metacortex Publishing hopes that you've enjoyed this presentation.
Please take a moment to listen to some other podcast offerings from Metacortex Publishing.
Cult Following is a podcast that studies the personalities and common traits of cult leaders and their followers. Get the real story behind these infamous and oftentimes tragic cults from a new perspective, through exhaustive research and from interviews with people that were there. Available anywhere you listen to podcasts.
A quest is a search for something. And every week, the Quest podcast will show you how we know what we know through interviews with people that have incredible stories of dedication and perseverance. I'm your host, Todd Fisher. Join me in this thought-provoking and inspiring podcast of discovery. Find us anywhere you listen to podcasts.
I'm Father Daniel DePlantis, a Catholic priest, martial artist, and host of the Karate Priest podcast. Have you ever wondered what the church teaches about different topics? Are you a martial arts enthusiast or just someone who wants to learn more about martial arts? I'd like to invite you to join me and many guests on my podcast as we cover topics of faith, everyday living, and martial arts on the Karate Priest podcast.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review this episode. This podcast is produced by Todd Fisher and Anthony Smith and is distributed by Metacortex Publishing. This podcast is copyright. Any previously trademarked or copyright content is used by permission. Information and opinions stated in this podcast should not be construed as medical advice. Please be sure to visit the official website for Metacortex Publishing at metacortexpublishing.com or find us on social media for other unique content.